I would understand practice before I did it. I think it's just the nature of having a kind of a lawyer mind. There's a way in which I could always, when I was in school, figure out what it was that the assignment was, or figure out what was expected of me, and then I would know what to do, and I would just go do it. So when I came into practice, that's the same kind of attitude I brought with it. This kind of, I'm going to figure it all out, and then I understand it, and then I'm going to go do it. But it never worked like that. Never did. I never had that understanding. In fact, it's only now, in retrospect, I can look back at my practice and say, damn, how did that happen? I mean, sometimes I put a lot of effort in practice, and sometimes it was all haphazard, and sometimes I would sit every day religiously, really good, and sometimes, you know, you couldn't pay me to sit on the cushion or anything. I mean, it was just this constant fluctuation of haphazardness, randomness. I have no idea. I cannot sit here and tell you how it is that my practice went from me sitting in a closet, not even sure that Buddhism wasn't some kind of devil worshiping, and me being a teacher. I can't tell you how that happened. I know it happened because I'm sitting here, but I can't tell you how it happened. And in some respects, that is the kind of opening you have to sort of have in this practice. It is as if you let go of the result you think the practice is going to bring you and pay more attention to just the ride itself, the walk itself, the journey itself. It doesn't matter. It's sort of like the first time, so I had a lot of restlessness, a lot of anxiety, and the first time I ever turned away from trying to get rid of the restlessness or the anxiety when I was sitting to watching the anxiety when I was sitting. That first, I remember that Sims moment when I was sitting in Sims. It was just a regular Tuesday night. I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden it went from trying to get rid of it to this turning towards, oh, just watching this. Oh, this is what anxiety is. Is it really anxiety? I mean, why do I call it that? And I remember wanting to know, what is it? How would I know it was anxiety? How would I know that? What was it exactly that made it anxiety versus, you know, irritation? How do I know this is what it is? And I started being more interested in watching and understanding what it was that I was calling anxiety, that I almost had this kind of appreciation for the anxiety being there. So I had something to look at. I was really sick of looking at the breath. So I needed something juicy, something that was, you know, big. And I think I shared with you guys last time I was here that moment at that retreat when I it changed my life. I had a sense that the Brahmaviharas were way more important than I had ever given it credit. Brahmaviharas being the heart energies of loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So I had always thought of those qualities, as something I had to do to get, you know, do the practices, get that, I'll be nice. But the wisdom of following the breath and freeing the mind and the wisdom practice seemed like that's real practice. The Brahmaviharas is just the nice stuff over on the side. I didn't really need that. But that is so far from the truth of Dhamma that I can't even... I mean, I think we should go back and start all over again and just do Brahmaviharas and then worry about the wisdom stuff later. Because in order for us to do what the Dhamma is asking, it has to come out of a softer, kinder heart. It won't come out of this harder, judgmental, critical mind. We have actually trained ourselves for generations to have a critical aspect of thinking. And that critical thinking is what got us into the developing world that we're in right now. But I don't know if it's all that good, because we've lost the softer, kinder heart energy. And that energy is what you're going to need in order to hold what it is that you see when you step out on the path. As soon as you step out on the path, you're basically saying to the universe, show me where I'm messing up my life. Show me, because I want to see it. And then as soon as we see it, we go running back to the hills because we don't really want to see it. So how is it that we could see the places where we're really deluded and creating a mess in our lives unnecessarily? How can we see how we're creating our own suffering and not run from it? That's what it is that the Dhamma is asking us. Don't run from what you see. One time I had this really difficult retreat with Rodney. And I had a lot of old memories coming up. And those of you that have ever had those old memories coming up, oh my God, it's so painful, because you're seeing something that you did wrong and regret and you wish you could fix it and nobody's around, everybody's gone, nobody wants to talk to you anyway because you messed up. And you're sitting here in a meditation sit looking at this stuff. And Rodney kept saying, sit through it, Tori. Just don't dwell on the story. Just keep your focus on the neutral and let it rise and fall. Let it rise and fall. And I'm sitting and sitting and sitting. By the end of that week long, I was so peaceful. It's like I rode right through it. And then Rodney gave this question and answer period, or gave a Dhamma talk. At the very end, it was the very last full night. Tomorrow we're going to pack up and leave. And the lights were all low and golden, and everybody's in the room, and it's all quiet and still. And he's giving this Dhamma talk. And he made this comment about, I sit in a chair, so I sit in the back. I'm probably the last chair, only black person at Cloud Mountain, sitting there all the way in the back. And Rodney made this comment that said that Dhamma creates eyes that allow you to see in a different way. So he said, imagine there's like this lion or this tiger charging at you. He said lion. Lions charging at you, full on. And you're standing there and you see these big giant paws and everything is just coming straight at you, just full on charge. And you think, oh my God, this lion's going to eat me. It's over. But then you get a closer look and you realize it doesn't have any teeth. It's just all gums. It can't really do anything. I lost it. I just burst into laughter and I could not contain myself. It was so true and so funny at the same time. And I was mortified because I thought Rodney would be offended that I was laughing in the middle of his Dhamma talk and he's all serious. But he didn't, he said. Ah, it's good to see you laugh, Tuareg. It's because he knew that you... It's hilarious, some of the reality of how foolish our suffering is. But we never know that sense of, are you kidding me? I'm upset about that? Really? We don't get that because we are so in the suffering that we don't sit back and notice what we're doing. So the first kind of quality we have to cultivate, this is a practice. This isn't something that you're going to get this weekend and then, okay, I got it. This is something you're going to do all day, every day. Learn to turn the mind towards softening. You look for it. I would consider it what I'd call a far-reaching metta. It's not that you're going to teach yourself how to be nice. It's not that kind of metta. This idea that we have in our Western minds that says, oh, metta is me being nice. So I'm going to develop a niceness. That's not what you're developing when you're developing metta. You're developing capacity. Metta is capacity. Metta is the quality that allows us to be able to be with some difficulty, some edge here. It is what allows us to be able to see some imperfection in ourselves, imperfection in the world, and tolerate it as being okay. It's the friendlier side of us. We all have it. I tell people all the time, we all have it. All you have to do is watch yourself. You can be yelling at your partner, and then the baby comes in. You're like, oh, how you doing? We can exit it anytime we want. My mother is primo. She would be yelling at all of us, and then the phone would ring, and she'd pick it up. Hello? She's like, oh, yes, everything's great, so beautiful. And she hang up, and I'm telling you guys, it's that we all have that capacity. And when we're in that friendlier, softer, compassionate kind of way, our ability to be with difficulty is very, very different. So if we're trying to take on some suffering that we see and we're asking the practice to show us, and then we want to take it on with this hard, critical, judging mind, it's going to eat us alive. We won't be able to do it. We'll just give up. Instead, we're asking the universe to send us suffering, so we want to see it. And we're going to have to soften around it. So we're going to have to practice, what does it mean to be soft? What does it mean to access that softer side? We have to look for it. We won't just know. We have to look for it in trees and look for it in flowers and look for it in rocks and look for it everywhere. Every room we walk into, we have to look for what's soft, what's light, what's tender, what seems very gentle here. So I can learn to see it as a part of my everyday life. Look for it everywhere, all the time. That learning to look for softening is actually, it's a misnomer, because the part of us that knows soft, that felt sense of tenderness and softness, is actually the body. The mind has a judgment of what is soft, and it'll look around and say, there's nothing soft in here. There's no softness here. So I don't even know why you're looking. But the heart, it doesn't matter where, it can find it. It can find it everywhere. It knows soft. It knows hard, it knows soft. So that's what we're kind of articulating, getting ourselves to. Look for it. Here's something Ajahn Chah said. He goes, you are your own teacher. Looking for teachers can't solve your own doubts. Investigate yourself to find the truth. Investigate yourself to find the truth inside, not outside. Knowing yourself is the most important thing. It's sort of that that you're doing. You are your body, this embodied aspect of you. You are going to teach yourself how to trust its version of softening, kindness, gentleness, not the mind's version, because the mind's version is subjected to television shows. It's subjected to our parents' views of what's nice and kind, the adults around us, the other kids at school, whether they thought being nice and kind was okay or not okay. Commercial, all these advertisers, they tell us what's good or bad, kind or not, should we be that way or not. So instead, we want to learn what this kindness, softening, metta capacity is from my own experience in that moment. And I'm telling you, every moment of your life has metta. There is no moment where metta is not there. You may not see it, but you have to look for it, but it's there. So I like what Jack Kornfield says. We need a repeated discipline, a genuine training in order to let go of our old habits of mind and to find and sustain a new way of seeing. So that's what you're developing. You're developing a discipline to look for kindness, softness. I call it softness, but it's kindness, friendliness. It's that capacity. When you feel yourself being all edgy, grumbly, energy towards all these beings around you, where's the soft side of you? It's there. Just have to look for it a little bit. The mind is certainly not going to want to go. But the heart knows how to find it. So there's three qualities here. The second one is what I would call a far-reaching stillness. It's learning to appreciate seclusion. And at first thought, you may think that seclusion means I gotta go off and I gotta be a monastic and get secluded like a hermit, like tucked in the woods somewhere. But that's not really what seclusion is. And this is why I think that urban practice is going to really change the nature of Buddhism. Because you're right, if we all had the monastic world, and we all kind of like those who want to be monastics, they go into the monastic life, and they're in there. And there is a kind of a separation between the monastic life and the lay life. And lay people support monastics, monastics support lay, especially in Asia. It's very much a different world. But there's still, there's monastic life, there's lay life. But over here in the West, man, we are like, I don't know what we are doing to this practice. I can't really tell you. Sometimes I'm a little nervous we might take the Buddha out of Buddhism. I'm a little worried about that. Might call it John Kabat-Zinnism. But at the same time, we have this opportunity because we practice this developing of meditation and we practice this development of a wisdom eye. So that coupled with living a lay life, it can be of great value if we begin to appreciate the seclusion. That's why you sit every day. You sit every day to learn to develop the skill of seclusion. We come to these retreats to learn to develop and appreciate the sense of this seclusion, of this stillness, so that when we soften, we can actually be still with whatever is arising. We have to practice that being still. We don't have a mind that's natural inclination is to be still. We have a mind whose natural inclination is to be stimulated. So we are practicing how to be still, even when there's all this movement and chaos about. And as I have some friends, lots of friends that are monastics, and they'll tell you, people think that when you go into a monastery, all the monks are all, you know, meditating all the time, or the nuns are meditating and doing stuff like that. But actually, they're working. And when they want to get seclusion, they got to also spend time going on a retreat so they can have some seclusion. This is a lot of work that they have to do. But they have to learn how to have stillness and seclusion in their... got something in my eye, it's killing me. How they have the stillness and seclusion in their everyday lives. That's what we're doing. We're not monastics. That's true. But we've taken on this kind of hybrid thing in the West of meditation and practice. So we are practicing bringing this seclusion, this stillness into our everyday lives. And in order to do that, we have to practice. We have to practice with learning to be able to sense into when am I still, even in the midst of chaos all about me. You want to see it. Let's see if I can find... Pema Chodron says, difficult things provoke all your irritations and bring your habitual patterns to the surface. And that becomes the moment of truth. You have a choice to launch into your lousy habitual patterns. Love, Pema. Or stay with the rawness and discomfort of the situation and let it transform you. But in order for us to do that, we're going to have to practice being still. Because can you not see the moving shakiness of our lousy habitual patterns? It's pushing us to fix this, do something. Right there, we got to find some stillness in order to be there. We won't be able to be there. No matter how much we don't like that habit pattern, and no matter how much we want to change it, if we have not cultivated a trust, an appreciation, a gratitude for stillness and seclusion, we will not be still when we really want to be still. We will go running into, okay, just one time. I'm going to be still with this. But this one time. We'll just keep doing that over and over and over. But there's another reason why we practice this seclusion, this stillness. It's this quote the Buddha said. It says, mindfulness is useful everywhere. Mindfulness is the sati, this capacity to remember and be still. Mindfulness is useful everywhere. For the mind finds refuge in mindfulness, and mindfulness is its protector. Without mindfulness, there can be no exertion or restraint of the mind. That's why. Remember yesterday when I started, said this monk told me that I need to figure out why did Buddha teach mindfulness. That's what it is. because mindfulness is the capacity to be still and just observe whatever is arising. Just observe it. Look at it. Let me see. Okay, I'm really angry right now. Okay, let me look at this anger and understand what this is. How come I call it anger? What is it exactly? Is there some pushing or what's going on? And I want to know what anger is rather than react because the mind says it's angry. This mindfulness, this capacity to be still with and pay attention to whatever is arising, is how we protect the mind. It's how we teach ourselves, I guess is the best way to say, teach the mind that it can actually be with something uncomfortable and it doesn't have to push it away. It could actually let something pleasant leave and not freak out. We can learn to do that if we learn to be still. But we sort of have to learn that stillness so that when the mind is captivated by something, we know, the body knows how to help the mind be still. The way we help babies who we're looking at them, they need to go to sleep. We all have been this. If you've ever been around an infant, they need to go to sleep. You can tell they got the rubbing of the eyes. They're just so sleepy they can barely hold their heads up. But then they start crying. They're crying and crying. And they just are so frustrated. And it's like what we call, they're too sleepy. They're too worked up. They don't know how to calm down and go to sleep. If you get worked up with them, you need to go to sleep. You can forget it because you two are going to be fighting a while. But if you calm down and you're just still with all their angst and almost sleep, then back up again and almost sleep, then back up again. You just are still with that. They can find their way to go to sleep. You are not reactive to their frustration because you know they really need to go to sleep. So in some respects, we have to have that kind of care around our lousy habitual patterns, a sense of being willing to observe that pattern rather than try to get rid of it, fix it. Why is it here? I've been working on this my whole life. I can't believe I'm back here. Rather than that, we want to get to know it, have some intimacy with it. And then the last one, I think, is a far-reaching wisdom. So this kind of a wisdom that we're looking at, I'm going to give you some quotes so I can kind of say what it is that we're doing. Buddha said, "He who sees the Dhamma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dhamma." Maybe I say it like this. Joseph Goldstein said, "One of the most radical, far-reaching, and challenging statements of the Buddha is his statement that as long as there is attachment to pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant, liberation is impossible." Take a couple more. Here's something from Pema. "What's encouraging about this meditation is that even if we shut down, we can no longer shut down in ignorance. We see very clearly that we're closing off. That in itself begins to illuminate the darkness of ignorance." Having been through both of those other stages, whatever he was talking about, our mind matures to a place where it's no longer moved. It does not grasp at pleasant things. It is not repelled by unpleasant things. Our mind attains deep, deep balance, like a calm, deep flowing river. Out of this mature place of equanimity, the conditions arise that open our mind suddenly to the unconditioned, to what is beyond body and mind, to freedom. And then I have one more. Every time we become aware of a thought, as opposed to being lost in a thought, we experience that opening of mind. Just as the light of a single candle can dispel the darkness of 1,000 years, the moment we light a candle, a single candle of wisdom, no matter how long or deep our confusion, ignorance is dispelled. I think I have a couple more. Just keep saying this. I think it's sort of like the pointing. The peace which arises from wisdom is not happiness, but is that which sees the truth of both happiness and unhappiness. And then I think I'll end here with Rumi. Oh soul, you worry too much. You have seen your own strength. You have seen your own beauty. You have seen your own golden wings. Why do you worry? That's what it is that this wisdom is talking about. This wisdom is you're beginning to see how natural and universal impermanence, dukkha, and non-self actually is. It's not just some Buddhist principle that we understand on an intellectual level. We really live in a world that's impermanent, full of dissatisfaction, and not personal. So when we begin to see that wisdom as the truth of it, then we can begin to look at whatever's happening in a moment in time and investigate the nature of it. We're trying to penetrate it and see it as it truly is. How much of this is my mind's overlay of not wanting to see the world as it truly is? And how much of this is learning to recognize the world as it truly is? That's what we're trying to see. You can see it. Just learn to soften. Practice looking for soft stuff all the time. If kindness is a better word, then look for kindness. But I think we can access kindness by looking for soft things first. So we look for soft things. We practice appreciating stillness, seclusion, and learn to just observe what's happening rather than trying to fix what's happening or do something about what's happening. We have to practice learning that seclusion of just observing rather than doing anything. And then finally, it's having this far-reaching wisdom, which allows yourself to open up to see those three characteristics, see them everywhere. They're all over the place. They're happening all the time. In every moment of discomfort, there is a characteristic there that you're having a difficult time with. So you're learning to turn towards investigating that moment rather than trying to fix it and get it better. That, I think, as we practice those things in and of themselves, just constantly looking for softness, constantly practicing observing, just shift our attention from doing something to observing. This constant sense of looking for the three characteristics, trying to see it, just creating allowing energy that's just like, oh, I'm going to allow whatever's happening and see what's going on. That capacity, we do it all the time, every day, regardless of what's going on, good, bad, or neutral. and we begin to develop a continuity of mindfulness. And that continuity of mindfulness, it protects the mind. It's the refuge that the mind needs, and it starts to calm down, get less reactive. Not because you did something to make it calm down, but because you are protecting it. It calms down on its own. I'll read a poem to end. Oh, that's right. I'm going to get it. I don't know if you guys know Alice Walker. But she has a poem I like. She says, "Expect nothing. Live frugally on surprise. Become a stranger to need of pity, or if compassion be freely given out, take only enough. Stop short of the urge to plead, then purge away the need altogether. Wish for nothing larger than your own small heart, or greater than a star. Tame wild disappointment with caress unmoved and cold. Make it a parka of your soul. Discover the reason why so tiny human midgets exist at all. So scared, unwise, but expect nothing. Live frugally on surprise." So let's sit a couple minutes here. I know you guys can't see, but you are very still.